This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, Sherry Holzer, winemaker of Rava Wines in Paso Robles, talks to Mira Honeycutt, host of Wine Country, about how sparkling wine is made.
Something that's so important about sparkling wine and the backbone of it is the acidity. So I do pick it earlier, about 18 bricks versus 25 bricks.
Then Megan Freeberg, director of the Cuesta College Central Coast Writers Conference, talks about this year's lineup.
We have 45 plus presenters. We are bringing back the teen programs. We are also bringing back master classes.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 7th, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with courage. Rosie Boltman is the news director of KCSB, the student-run radio station at UC Santa Barbara. She joins us with a brand new segment. It's called Standing in Courage, and it explores social justice, activism, and health through conversations with people on the Central Coast.
Hello. My guest today is Linda Baker, San Luis Obispo County Coordinator for the No Kings protest. Linda Baker is an organizer with the San Luis Obispo branch of Indivisible. Indivisible is a progressive political organization formed in 2016 dedicated to fighting fascism and upholding democracy. Welcome, Linda Baker.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here.
Can you start off by introducing yourself?
I am a relatively recent person here on the Central Coast. I've lived here about 8 years. I'm Boulder, so this is a retirement area for me. I got involved in politics back in Seattle, where I was an elected representative. I've been part of the Democratic Central Committee there. And here in the Central Coast, I got involved in politics again. I was the campaign manager for Susan Funk when she ran for the city council and was involved with some progressive politics here.
Let's jump into the No Kings protest. Why was the massive anti-Trump protest in June called the No Kings protest?
Well, one of the reasons is to play off of Trump himself, who at some time said that he would like to be a king, but also as a protest against the executive overreach that characterizes his administration. You know, we got rid of our king and we don't want to have another one. There were many examples of Trump's overreach and with military deployments and without state consent, $45 million tax-funded birthday parades, federal troops deployed to chill dissent in Los Angeles, many, many executive orders which really overstepped his authority to do, and backlash against institutions that dared to try to stop him.
And the No Kings protest took place on Flag Day, Saturday, June 14th.
Right.
What were the goals going into the protest, and do you think that those goals were met?
One of the goals of any large rally like this is to buoy the spirits of people who are angry, upset, want something to do, want to be out in public, need action in their lives in order to feel better about things, sometimes feel isolated, like they're the only ones who feel the way they do. And when you come out, like I was mostly involved in the one in Atascadero, which is a more conservative part of our county, and people there were really glad. We had over 1,200 people on the street there, and people were really glad to be part of a group of people who believed the way they did, to see each other. It was joyous, it was fun. And then the other purpose is to reduce fear. A lot of people are concerned about reprisal. They've never been involved in a protest before. They don't want to be out in public. They're afraid to take a stand. And when they see other people out there demonstrating, ordinary people like ourselves, pushing back, it gives them the strength that they need to overcome their fear and get involved. So one of the roles of big protests like this is to broaden the group of people that are interested.
And you just talked a lot about community involvement. Were there any specific political aims of these protests, or was it more reaching the everyday person?
Well, one of the reasons that it was done on June 14th is because it was Flag Day, as you said, and also Trump's birthday, and a counter-protest to the use of force that was represented by the military parade, the $45 million military parade that was in Washington, D.C. on that time, at that day. So part of it is also to show that nonviolence works, that their political goal was to show that there is a large number of people who disagree with the Trump administration. There were over 5 million people that turned out on that day in over 1,200 sites across the United States. One political goal, of course, is to attract media attention, and the size of the pushback did get a lot of media attention. And these things are actually working. I think often people will say, well, what good does protest do? But there are signs that the administration has stepped back on some things when they get a lot of public flack and also media attention that brings attention to things that they're doing that people might not otherwise know about.
As you've mentioned, the national No Kings protest was one of the biggest single-day protests in U.S. history, and in Slo County, they took place in San Luis Obispo, Atascadero, and Cambria. You already talked a little bit about the turnout, but what was it like out there on the street, and can you talk about the process of organizing a local element of such a large nationwide event?
Well, thank you. Those are interesting questions and things that people don't often think about. One of the things that was nice about this particular thing is that we've had previous large rallies in San Luis Obispo before. Because that city is in the middle of our county, that has been the center of political activities. But one of the things we liked about No Kings is that it was distributed. We had an event on the coast, we had an event in the North County, we had the central event in San Luis Obispo. And we did that deliberately, not so much looking for one huge event, although it was about the same as April 5th in downtown, but showing that there was a broad group of people all over the county, including in the more conservative part of our county, that were working together to express the same interest and express their outrage and their concern. And in order to do that, we have a coalition of people. Indivisible is, in our county, is six different groups. Each one of them represents a certain geographic area, and they're all autonomous, but then we work together for joint activities. And then we have a broader coalition of people that work with us as well. The downtown gathering was organized largely by 5051, which is a similar group that started by a slightly younger group of people, and then also the Democratic Central Committee of our county. So, for example, with Atascadero, we had two indivisible groups in the North County and two Democratic clubs who worked together. So we have a series of meetings where we talk about what each of us is going to do. We each of us have a set of volunteers, and so we'll put out a volunteer call that we each of us provide volunteers for. We are all nonviolent groups, and so we also provide training for our volunteers in what we call de-escalation techniques, which is ways of making sure that we ourselves are not violent, but also that if heated situations arise, we know how to deal with them. So we also provide training to people who want to be involved, want to channel their feelings into action, which makes most people feel better, but they don't maybe have the leadership training or the skills for this kind of a public protest. So we help them with that.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Rosie Boltman talking to Linda Baker about her local role in the progressive political organization Indivisible. There were multiple local and state officials in attendance at the protest. How do you hope that they respond to the No Kings protest in San Luis Obispo County?
Well, we are blessed locally in that all of our officials, and this is true not every part of California, which isn't quite as united as it's sometimes portrayed, but in our area, all of our local officials are very supportive of democracy, very supportive of our right to protest, and actually are already doing quite a bit to promote some of those goals. We do want, in general, the movement to see more leadership from our legislative branch, and maybe that's one thing that comes out of these protests. Is it's similar with public officials, who are just people, after all, in that if they see other public officials standing up, not just saying something, not just answering constituent calls, but actually in the street with ordinary people, then it's inspiring, and then maybe others will come forward also.
You said that some local officials are already promoting the goals and ideals of No Kings following the protest. Do you have any examples of how these officials are dealing with the Trump administration on the local and state level in the weeks after No Kings?
I don't know if I could give an example of something that was immediately following. They were already doing town halls. They were already, you know, promoting laws at the state level. Well, actually, that might be new. One of the goals of No Kings was protection of vulnerable populations. And we're all familiar with the abductions, the kidnappings of people off the street by people who don't identify themselves and wear masks and show up at night and drag people off the street. And so a state law is now being proposed by the California legislature to make it illegal for them to wear masks, to be masked in public, and that they must identify themselves, because these people are essentially bounty hunters, and it's not even clear that some of them are government authorities, and that may be one of the reasons why they're masked.
Transitioning a little bit, another major political event of our time, which is championed by student organizers at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo and community groups like the Central Coast Anti-War Coalition, is the ongoing war on Gaza. Was the war addressed at the protest?
It wasn't in Atascadero, and I don't think it was in Cambria. Because of the focus on the administration, not because it's not an important issue, but because it was less of an issue for this particular protest than it has been for other things. I did not hear all of the speakers that spoke downtown, so I can't say whether or not one of them actually mentioned that. I think it was just seen as not a central issue to this particular event, not that it wasn't important overall.
Can you explain a little bit more then about how the issues that the protest focused on were chosen?
Well, there's a couple of ways things bubble up. Indivisible and 5051, and I think you could say that for the Democratic Party locally too, are grassroots organizations who get a lot of their ideas from the people who are members. The two leaders of Indivisible, for example, Ezra Levine and Leah Greenberg, have a weekly call for an hour every Thursday where they say a little bit about what's happening in Washington, D.C., but the rest of the time they just answer questions for the local leadership of each group and indicate what's important to them. So some of that bubbles up from the people who are members of these activist groups, and they say, this is what the issue is in my community. Like, immigration is particularly important in my community, for example. And so then they set a direction nationally. The No Kings event, for example, was set by the several national organizations started it. MoveOn.org was one of them. Indivisible was one of them. And then there were a multitude of other coalition groups that signed on. And they give us a general direction. They have the slogan, they have the graphics, they have some of the ideas. And then how you actually operationalize it in your own community depends on what kind of volunteer support you have, how the theme resonates locally, how you decide to make it clear to local people what the points are. So it's kind of both bottom up and top down kind of a thing.
I want to touch on something else really quick. The Slow No Kings protests weren't just protests. They provided community aid. Can you talk about the decision to include things like the Atascadero food drive in the No Kings protest and the impact that these actions had?
The direction that the movements are taking is not just to talk about what we are against, but what we stand for, what our values are, and how we can represent those values to the members of the movement and to the wider public. And one of our values for No Kings in particular was protection, protecting our democracy, protecting our constitution, protecting our civil rights. And part of that was protecting vulnerable communities. So in Atascadero, the way we decided to do that is to have a food drive because many of the local food banks have been hit really hard by larger numbers of people requiring food support and loss of federal subsidies that many of them depended upon. And so that's why we chose food. Interestingly, the first food bank that we approached was a little concerned about being allied with a political movement, enough concerned that they wouldn't even accept food from us, which was a little bit of a surprise for me. But they are nonprofits, and because of that, they have to be careful. We wound up giving the food to the local homeless shelter there, and we collected about a van load of bags of food and were able to take it over and give it to them. And they used it in their own feeding program, ECHO, the El Camino homeless organization. And then they gave the extra to the food bank, so that our local food bank, ELF, so that it came from them rather than coming from us. And that way we were able to help both. But the idea of it is that we have to help each other. You know, we're all in this together, and we need to support each other and those who are most in need in our community.
So coming to the end here, how does your organization plan to continue fostering political momentum against the Trump administration now that the No Kings protest is over?
Well, there's a couple things coming up. One of them is July 17. Again, a national movement called Good Trouble Lives On, which is July 17 is the 15th anniversary of the death of John Lewis, senator and civil rights activist. His slogan was, make good trouble. So on July 17, there'll be another national event. Locally, we're doing that with a rally in Paso from 5 to 6 p.m. at 12th and Spring. Indivisible National is going into training, so they have something called 1 Million Rising, which if you're interested in getting involved in organizing, there's training for how to do that from their website, indivisible.org. We have a newsletter that goes out to over 500 activist groups and individuals in our county, which has a list of all the ways that people can get involved in a single week. So if you get that, you would find out what local rallies are. Currently, there's a phone bank that's being planned by many nationals to fight back against the big bad bill that is going to result in people losing their Medicare coverage and huge national debt. And there's a push in the next couple of days to pass that bill. So there's phone banks against that. There's listings of ways to contact your representatives. And then there's also listings by related groups, like ecological groups and the League of Women Voters, and they all post things in that newsletter. So if you're interested, you could contact me and I'll get you hooked up. We also have ongoing overpass bridge protests. Some of our groups have individual things planned for the month of July. So if people locally rallies on the street and perhaps a candlelight village in Santa Maria for those folks in our community that have already been taken by ICE. So if people are interested in that, they can contact me personally at lmbadvisor@gmail.com, and I can get them hooked up with the newsletter so that they will get more notice about this or tell them more about the details of these individual events if they're interested.
Thank you so much for being on today.
Yes, thank you very much for the opportunity.
That was Linda Baker from Indivisible San Luis Obispo talking to us about her role organizing the No Kings protest. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Rosie Boltman, and you're listening to Standing in Courage.
This is KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Up next is Wine Country with Meera Honeycutt, a wine journalist and co-author of the recently published book, Sideways Uncorked, The Perfect Pairing of Film and Wine. Meera brings us stories from the Central Coast wine region through her conversations with local vintners and winemakers.
Today is all about bubbles. And let's get one thing straight. A sparkling wine can only be called champagne when it's exclusively produced from grapes grown, harvested, and made into wine within the demarcated region of Champagne in France's northern region. All other bubbly is simply sparkling wine. And to give us a lowdown on sparkling wine is my guest Sherry Holzer, winemaker at Rava, the Paso Robles winery dedicated to the production of bubbles. Sherry Holzer, welcome to Wine Country.
Hi, Meera. Thank you for inviting me.
First off, tell us about Rava Wines, its vineyards and production, and what's new.
All right. Rava Wines, we're in Paso Robles, and we're the first winery to focus on sparkling wine, especially making it the traditional champagne method. And we're a smaller winery, but we're also known a lot for our events out there. We have this beautiful event center where we do a lot of weddings and galas and things like that. Most of our production is sparkling wine, but we also do some still wines, mm-hmm. meaning without bubbles. We do a Cabernet, we do Italian blend, and a still rosé. And things that are new, we're excited this week. We were just awarded Best of Show, Best of Class for Best Sparkling Wine.
Wow.
And for the Central Coast Wine Competition. It's our newest sparkling rosé. It's made out of Cinso. And yeah, we're really proud of that. And yeah, we're excited to release it this week.
Congratulations on that. So the Rava Estate, what's the acreage vineyard planting there?
The estate is in Monterey County and also the property around Paso Robles. Altogether, it's about 1,200 acres. 500 of the acres are in Paso around the tasting room. And I believe there's about 15, I think, different varietals grown on the Paso property. And
wow.
At least 10 on the Monterey property. The Ravas are really big into grape growing and farming. And, right. you know, first and foremost, that was their love and their start. So at Rava, we get a small amount of their grape production. A lot of it is sold to other wineries.
Yeah. What's your annual production of, let's say, sparkling wine?
It's a little trickier for sparkling wine because we don't, you know, release it regularly like a regular winery necessarily would. But I would say about 4,000 cases is kind of a good target average.
Right, right. You also produce for other wineries as well, right?
Yeah, we do. And that's actually one of my favorite parts of my job. We do what we call custom crush for other wineries. So to make sparkling wine, the equipment is so specialized right. and expensive. If you were a winery that only made one or two sparkling wines, it wouldn't pencil out to own this equipment. So Lauren and Chad Rava, I think, are generous to allow others to send me their base wine and I'll make it into sparkling wine for them. You know, it's their wine, their label and everything, but they're able to take advantage of the equipment that we have. And it's a nice business that we have.
Right.
And the benefit of that is you could probably see in Paso Robles and on the Central Coast that the production of sparkling wine has increased a lot. When you go into tasting rooms now, a lot of people have a sparkling wine, and you know, that makes us happy.
Right. I think just about everybody is now making a sparkling of some sort, even if it's just a rosé. To start off, you know, they want a rosé, and you see a lot of sparkling rosé around.
Yeah, and rosé is actually my favorite sparkling to make. But
yeah.
I think it's important that a tasting room has a sparkling wine, especially if you're a winery that has events. You know, it's always nice to have a sparkling wine to celebrate and to toast.
It's very celebratory. So speaking of which now, so the craft of sparkling wine, walk us from step one to the final stage. And also tell us the difference between the so-called traditional method, which is also the Champenoise method, which Rava is known for, and then the tank method. What's the difference between the two productions? But first of all, let's take step one from grape to bottle.
Yeah, the beginning of both of those, the tank method and the traditional method, start the same. I pick my grapes, I harvest them earlier than I would for a normal wine.
Mm-hmm.
For example, my sparkling Chardonnay, I pick probably three, almost 4 weeks before I would our regular Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that we do that is I want the grapes to have a lower amount of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is sugar equals alcohol. So if I pick it with lower sugar, my base wine will have lower alcohol. And then also, as the grapes sit and ripen on the vine, they start to lose their acidity.
Mm-hmm.
And something that's so important about sparkling wine and the backbone of it is the acidity.
Mm-hmm.
So I do pick it earlier, about 18 and a half Brix versus 25 Brix, just to retain the acidity and get the lower sugar. So I start harvesting usually the beginning of August, and often we're done around Labor Day. And that's when my other winemaking friends that make normal wine are just starting to get going. And, you know, I'm wrapping it up. So my harvest is earlier than the traditional. Then I make the wine.
So you make the base wine.
So this is the base wine or the cuvée.
Yeah.
And it's made similar way, except for we don't press it as hard. And the grapes have to be picked by hand. We don't want any of the berries to get crushed or any of the juice to be released. They're picked cold at night by hand. They come in these small bins, just the most delicate way possible. Put them into a press. Even the red grapes are made like a white wine. That's how you get, you know, the Blanc de Noir.
Right, right.
And
no skin contact, no color.
No, yeah, correct, course, correct, yeah. Yep. Except for the rosé, we get a little bit of skin contact.
Right.
But essentially, I make everything like I would a white wine. We don't press it very hard. It's mainly gravity because we want the cleanest, the best juice to start with for our cuvée. Then I make it into a regular wine, but because it has lower sugar, the base wine has a lot lower alcohol to start with.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is when we do the second fermentation where we get the bubbles, the alcohol increases. So I want to start a little lower because I'm going to gain some. So this is actually where it separates from the traditional champagne method and the tank method or the Prosecco method. I put the base wine into each bottle separately and add a yeast and sugar to each bottle, where in the tank method, the base wine is in the tank and you add all of the yeast and the sugar into the tank and it's one big fermentation versus each bottle's its own little fermentation.
So it's individual fermentation in each bottle.
Correct.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
How that translates when you're tasting it is the bubbles and the bottle fermentations, what we do at Rava, they're tighter, they're smaller, they last the entire glass. They're just fine little beads where a Prosecco, for example, you know, the bubbles are bigger, a little more aggressive, and then the wine gets flat pretty quick.
So the smaller the bubble, the better?
Yes, And also, the bubbles are important. I think one of the most important things about sparkling, but it also affects the flavor. When you do the tank Prosecco method, you're not getting the really interesting yeasty characteristics that champagne is known for, like the brioche, the biscuity, kind of that yeasty thing, which you tend to look for in a fine champagne. So it affects the flavor and it affects the bubbles. The Prosecco way of doing it is a lot cheaper and it's a lot less labor. So making the traditional sparkling is really a labor of love, and it takes right. 3 years and everything's done by hand. And
so then it's in a bottle. The bottles lay down now for how long?
Typically about 3 years.
Okay.
In Champagne, they have very strict rules. It has to be 7 years. We don't have any, you know, restrictions like that in California. But at Rava, we like to lay things down for at least 3 years for the Chardonnays. The rosés are a little quicker. And the reason is I don't want as much yeasty characteristic. I want it to be kind of a brighter strawberry, mm-hmm. Watermelon. So that's a style decision.
So now what happens next to the bottle?
So these bottles are laying down, and they're in these wooden bins. They're laying flat on top of each other. It's called an entourage. And now the hard part is to get all that dead yeast that's in the bottle out of the bottle, because that's the actual bottle that you're buying and drinking.
You can see the dead yeast coming
down. And you can see the dead yeast
at the neck of the bottle. Right?
And the dead yeast is where all the flavor's at, you know, so that's the good stuff. But no one wants any cloudy bottles. So that's where the riddling comes in.
Tell us about the riddling process.
So in traditional Champagne, they would use these A-frame racks, and someone would actually turn each bottle by hand every day, and there's an art to it.
Yeah, it's a time-honored tradition.
Yes,
which
I
believe a lot of champagne houses are using hand riddling in Champagne.
Yeah. And you know, these people that are doing that are have these amazing arms, just all muscle.
Yeah, and they can go up to like thousands of bottles a day. I mean, there's records somewhere.
There's an art to it. Yeah,
there's
for
an
sure.
art. Yeah, yeah.
We don't do that.
No.
I do not do that.
But you have a machine there, right?
Yeah,
tell us
everything
about that.
We do is it's automated there, and it's way more efficient. You
right.
get a better riddling, meaning we get all the yeast in a nice hard pallet. So we take the bottles by hand out of these wooden bins where they've been storing for 3 years, and they're put into these metal cages that sort of rotate and vibrate in the air. And at the end of this riddling cycle, all the bottles are necked down with a yeast compact in the neck of the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next step is we open the caps on the bottles, the yeast sprays out, and we have a nice clean sparkling wine left in it, and then we put a real cork in it with a wire hood. And so it's a lot messier and a lot harder than the Prosecco tank method, where they would just rack right out of a tank clean into the bottle.
That's quite a process.
It is quite a process.
Yeah,
and it's really fun. And also what I love about the traditional method is if you have some bottles laying next to each other that were bottled within 30 seconds, because they're their own little fermentation, they will taste slightly different. And I think that's just so cool about sparkling wine.
Yes. Yeah. If you're just joining us, this is Wine Country, and I'm Mira Honeycutt. My guest is Sherry Holzer, winemaker at Rava Wines, and today it's all about bubbles. So, Sherry, what got you into winemaking? And that too in such a specialized side of the industry.
I grew up in North Idaho, up in Coeur d'Alene, and it's definitely not wine country up there, and I wasn't really surrounded by wine drinking, but I worked at a really nice resort where we sold a lot of wine, and then I started to taste it and get into it because I needed to sell it. And I started to enjoy, you know, what makes a Cabernet taste different from Merlot, and then what makes a Washington Merlot taste different from a California Merlot. And I was going to school as a chemist, and I was a botanist.
Oh.
And so I was, you know, kind of geeking out on the chemistry part of it. Then I found out a winemaker's job is mainly chemistry and microbiology. And so
it is. You go.
Yeah. So I'm essentially a chemist.
Yes.
And instead of going into, I think my path was going to be pharmaceuticals, I definitely, you know, took a sharp left and went towards making wine, and because it is a nice combination of botany and chemistry and microbiology. So
right.
it was a good fit.
And how did you get to Paso?
At the time when I was up in Idaho, there was two schools that were really choices, Fresno State or UC Davis, to get a winemaking degree. I didn't think I can just come to California and jump into a winery without having any background. So I did want to, you know, get the formal training. So I went to Fresno State, and they have a winery there, and I loved it. And one of my first trips from Fresno was to Paso Robles, and I fell in love with it right away. It reminded me of home. I like the small community. I love the area. I knew I would want to be on the Central Coast. I also knew that I wanted to make sparkling wine. To me, that was the most interesting. I think it's the hardest thing to make. And I love the, you know, celebration part about it and opening bubbles. And so my first job after I graduated was up in Healdsburg at Jay Sparkling Wines. And I just fell in love with sparkling wine then. I knew I was coming to Paso Robles, and at the time, there wasn't any sparkling facilities here. Right. And so I was ecstatic when the Ravas opened their sparkling house. And now I feel like I've kind of come full circle, and I'm back to what I started doing.
And you're making wines for so many other wineries, so that's a big responsibility.
Yeah, I love it. We do make a lot of wines.
How many clients would you have, approximately?
I would say we probably have about 15 clients.
That you make sparkling wine for?
Yeah.
Are they all in Paso or along Central Coast?
No, actually throughout California.
Okay.
And then for the Rava label, gosh, we make, I think, 15 to 20 different sparkling wines and SKUs and varieties.
Right. Those are very interesting. Tell me some of the, I mean, you have some unique varieties that you're making sparkling wine of, right? Gewurztraminer, Grüner Veltliner, what other unique varieties?
And that's actually another part about my job that I love so much is we do the traditional three, you know, champagne grapes that they would use in champagne, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier. But we also, since we're in Paso, we like to do things a little differently. And because Chad grows so many different varieties of grapes, we get the option of making them into sparkling. Right now, my focus has kind of been on Rhone varieties, and I think they grow so well in Paso, and they've made some beautiful sparklings. Mm-hmm. So we have a series that's Grenache Blanc, and we have a Grenache Noir Rosé, and I have a Cinsault, and a Cinsault Rosé, and a Pique Pool that are all sparkling. But we also do Muscat, we do a Riesling, we do a Grüner Veltliner, we have a number of blends, Pinot Blanc, Albarino. I know I'm missing a few, but yeah, we do it all.
do you have a favorite grape variety that you like in a sparkling wine?
I would say as a generalization, I love making rosés, but I would say Grenache has definitely always been one of my favorites, making a Grenache rosé. And I also love Albarino. I love the racing acidity of it, and I love the pineapple, and I think the sparkling Albarino is one of our top wines.
It is. I've tasted it, and it's just really delicious.
Thank you.
Tell us, Rava is committed to giving back to the local community, right? They do a lot of events and all, and I believe its annual cancer support community event is coming up pretty soon. So give us the details for those who might want to attend.
Yeah, they do a number of things, but for specific for cancer, Chad Rava is a two-time cancer survivor, so this is something that's near and dear to him. We have an annual event out at Rava, which raises a lot of money. It's called the Sabes Wings event. Mm-hmm. This year, it's on Saturday, October 4th, and we get a really big turnout. They do a nice auction, a nice dinner, and they raise quite a bit of money for the Sabes Wings organization. And the organization raises money for families that are struggling financially, for people that have cancer, just bills and daily things that, you know, it's expensive to pay your medical bills. And as part of that, and one of Chad's contributions is we have a special wine that we made with a Sabes Wings label. And 100% of the proceeds of that also go towards the organization.
And those who are interested, can they contact Rava? Do you have a website?
Yep, ravawines.com, and under the events, it talks about the Sabes Wings event. Mm-hmm. And also another thing with the Sabes Wings wine that we do, it's called our legacy wine. John Clark is Rava's founding winemaker, and he had passed away from cancer a couple of years ago. And the wine that we released for the Sabes Wings was one of his last wines. And so, you know, it also is very meaningful in that way, too.
One last question. What do you prefer, sparkling wine in a flute glass or like a regular white wine glass? What do you prefer?
You know, if I am evaluating it for the purposes of you know, judging it with another wine or picking it apart or, you know, being sciencey about it. I love a regular wine glass.
Right.
Because it will pull out any possible flaw that would be in there. But if I'm out celebrating or enjoying it with dinner, enjoying it with friends, I love a flute. I just love to watch the bubbles in it.
Right. And it looks so elegant.
It looks elegant and it traps the bubbles better. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm a flute girl. Yeah, I do like flutes.
Flute girl.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sherry, for joining us today and giving us a deep dive into how you make the bubbles.
Thank you for the invite, Mira. It's always lovely to come and talk with you.
You are listening to Paso Robles winemaker Sherry Holzer talking about sparkling wines produced at Rava Winery. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Mira Honeycutt, and this is Wine Country.
Next, my interview with Megan Freeberg, director of the Cuesta College Central Coast Writers Conference.
It happens on September 26th and 27th this year, but we're interviewing her in July because the deadline to buy your tickets for the early bird special is July 10th. You can register for the conference at centralcoastwritersconference.com. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me today. I appreciate it.
So tell us about this conference. How long has it been happening for, and what can we expect this year that's different than what it was last year?
So this is the 41st annual Cuesta College Central Coast Writers Conference. It's a mouthful. We say CCWC for short. And so for 41 years, this has been going strong. It was started years ago by a couple of ladies at Cuesta, and then it's gone through several directors who have been helping me. This is my first year as a director, so that's different from last year. So I've been the volunteer coordinator for about 12 years, and so I kind of know the ins and outs of this conference, and they asked me to step up to be the director this year in 2025, so I'm very excited about that.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. We have a wonderful team. With Cuesta College, we are under their community programs division. And then, of course, they run all sorts of wonderful programs. Right now, they have College for Kids going on, a lot of summer programs. And then the Writers Conference happens once a year. So as you mentioned, this year it's happening in September. It'll be Friday and Saturday, September 26th and 27th. And what's different this year is for those who remember past years when we had the conference for 2 or 3 days, then 2020 hit, right? And the pandemic and everything got shut down and we couldn't meet in person. And so we took it online in 2020. Then for a couple of years after that, we were only able to do a couple of online, like we had a teen program online, but we didn't have it in person. So these last 2 years, our previous director, Brian Schwartz, brought it back for 1 day to kind of ease back into it. And it went really great. This year, I'm expanding it to 2 days. So it's going to have more bang for your buck. And we have some wonderful presenters. We have 45 plus presenters. We are bringing back the teen programs. We are also bringing back master classes, which we haven't had since, I think, 2019, or I think we did it online in 2020. And we are also bringing back a short series of pitches and consult sessions with, we have some agents and publishers, and we have some editors. So that's always really popular. So we have a little bit of everything for everybody.
Is this conference for established and published authors, or is it also for somebody who may be a newbie and is interested in writing and exploring it?
All of the above. The Central Coast Writers Conference is well known for being welcoming and accommodating, and we just want everybody to be there, whether you just write in your journal every day and you want to learn a little bit more about, you know, maybe you're thinking about writing a novel, or perhaps you want to write a memoir to share just only with your family. You know, you might not be thinking about being a published author. We just say, if you write, you are a writer, and we want you to be there. So established writers, yes, we have plenty that have published books. They've done screenplays. They've done films. They've produced books of poetry. We have a full range. And so the offerings that we have there will accommodate that, whether you're a beginner or perhaps maybe you haven't written for a while and you want to just take some of those beginner classes to refresh things, or you're established and you're thinking, well, let's see, I wrote this novel, but I'd love to see it as a movie. How do I turn this into a screenplay? We're going to have some screenwriters there too. So it is for everybody.
Do you want to share with us some of the highlights for the conference, such as the guest speakers who are coming in and some key workshops that you're having? And you also mentioned that there's a particular theme for this conference.
Yes, thank you. This year's theme is It's Time. My hope is to encourage attendees that it's time to either start writing, finish a writing project that maybe you have shoved away somewhere, connect with fellow writers. That's a big part of our conference, is finding your tribe and connecting with others that are like-minded. Maybe you want to reach out to an agent, or maybe you want to take steps towards publishing your work. So whether you're coming to the conference and you're a teenager and you're hoping to delve into the world of fantasy, fiction, or perhaps you're a young mom that wants to reignite your passion for poetry that you pushed aside for a while, or maybe you're a middle-aged school teacher that has been chipping away at your novel for many years, or you're an older grandparent that wants to learn more about writing your memoir. Wherever you are in your writing life, now is the time to come to the conference and learn more. So that's kind of our theme. Wherever you are, now is the time to take the next step. And then as far as some of our speakers, oh my goodness, we have so many. I'll start with our opening and closing keynote speakers, who are both just amazing. Our opening keynote is Brooke Warner. And if you go to brookwarner.com, you'll learn a little bit more about her. She's coming to us from the Bay Area, and she's a publisher of She Writes Press, which is very well known for publishing works of female authors or underserved communities. She's a memoir coach. She's written a few books on memoir. She's a TEDx speaker, and she is just a go-getter. And she is just going to be the perfect person to kick off the conference. So she's our opening keynote. And then in between, we are going to have many amazing presenters. We have, again, about 45 plus presenters. We set up the conference with tracks. So for instance, there'll be one on memoir. There'll be one on children and young adult writing. There'll be one on publishing. So whether you want to learn about self-publishing or hybrid publishing or finding an agent, there'll be a track on screenwriting, because as I'll talk about our closing keynote, he's a screenwriter for many movies that you'll recognize. Rob Edwards, he's going to be doing the masterclass on screenwriting also. But for Rob, if you look up robedwards.com, many people will know him by the movies that he's done. He has written two classic animated films for Walt Disney. One was The Princess and the Frog, which was Academy Award, Golden Globe nominated. Also Treasure Planet. This year alone, he has three films that were released. One that a lot of people know him by is Marvel's Captain America, which came out earlier this year. There was a faith-based one called The King of Kings that was animated. And then he has one that's out now called Sneaks. He's a 20-year veteran of television. He worked with The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Full House, A Different World, In Living Color. A lot of people will recognize it. And he's an adjunct professor at USC. And he loves to teach. He loves coming to the conference. And he's just a great guy all around.
I would think it's a difficult decision based on what you told me. It all sounds really interesting. If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Meher Ali, talking to Megan Freeberg, director of the upcoming Cuesta College Central Coast Writers Conference. It happens on September 26th and 27th right here in San Luis Obispo at Cuesta College. You can register for the conference and buy tickets at centralcoastwritersconference.com. So I'm actually curious to know how you went about organizing this conference and selecting the guest speakers that you did and the workshops as well.
Organizing it, I learned from past directors, because as I mentioned, I started out just as an attendee going there and fell in love with it. Once you go to the conference, you will keep coming back. I guarantee it. And then I was volunteering. So I was able to get to know a lot of people. Many of those people are coming back. that I've gotten to know over the years. Plus, for me personally, I'm a freelance writer. So I'm in that writing world. And I write for a few different local publications. And my husband and I travel all over. So I'm always doing articles. And, you know, you connect with people. You find somebody else who's writing a book, or you find somebody who just put this movie out. Just over the years, there's a list of people that I've connected with, and I reach out to them first, the ones that I knew, and then lots of times they recommend somebody. We're like, well, you're doing a poetry track. I know somebody who might want to be part of this, and then I'll look into it and reach out to them. And I have so many people who want to be part of this, which is a wonderful problem to have, because there's so many that want to come to the conference. They love coming to the Central Coast. They love, you know, going to the wineries in Paso Robles, going to Morro Bay, exploring San Luis Obispo, and they come from all over. We're actually already planning for next year. I have a list of people who can't make it this year for one reason or another. They have another event going on, but they're, please put me down for next year. So we're already building next year's list. So people want to be presenters here. They love it. They love the intimacy of the conference. As you know, it's in San Luis Obispo. It's a smaller area. And so stepping away from maybe something that's in LA or New York or whatever, which are wonderful conferences, but coming here, it's very intimate. You get to have a lot of those one-on-one connections.
Tell us a little bit more about the master classes.
The master classes, the pitches, and the consults are optional to purchase. The master classes will be $150, and they are 3-hour sessions. And it's a smaller group, a smaller cohort, so to speak. And so during that time, you can learn a lot, whether you're taking one on memoir or one on screenwriting, you're going to have a professional that's going to be with you for 3 hours, just going over everything. They are pretty popular. The masterclasses aren't up on the website yet, but there will be a link. So it is separate. And people that aren't coming to the conference, if they just want to go to the masterclass, they can do that too.
Is there a scholarship or any kind of opportunity for folks who are not able to afford to be able to attend this conference?
There's several options. So we don't want the price to be a deterrent from anybody. We really want to try to find a way. You know, with that being said, it does cost quite a bit to put this on, to bring people in, to pay for the venue, the food. We feed everybody, you know, but we try to find ways to make it affordable. So you can sign up to be a volunteer. And we do have a lot of people who come back. So those are limited, but there's a link on our website that will say, if you want to volunteer, you can reach out to me. And I have a volunteer coordinator that I'm working with this year that will help find a way to try and if somebody's interested in that.
In addition to volunteering, are there any other ways in which people can join who are perhaps not financially able to?
Yes, absolutely. So we are working with the County of San Luis Obispo library system right now, and we should have information up on our website soon, but we are going to be working with them to provide scholarships if they have an essay that is chosen. And it will be available at each 14 of their locations. We also are going to offer scholarships under a couple of people's names that have been part of the conference that have since passed away. And so these will be for anybody who might be battling an illness or recovering from an illness, that we want to make sure that they know that we want them there and we want them to get their story told. So all of the information on various scholarships will be available. And then if there is a financial hardship, please just reach out to me on the website. We will do what we can to make it work for you. Our website is centralcoastwritersconference.com.
So share a little bit more about other details related to the conference. Is there any particular one that you're personally looking forward to attending? Or you can't say?
Oh my gosh. Well, to be honest with you, I just love them all because there's a little bit of everything for everybody. And, you know, it's kind of like picking out a gift for your favorite person, right? You usually pick out something that you will like yourself, right? And that's what happens with these presenters and the classes that they're having, the workshops. I think whenever I'm talking to them and they tell me about what their presentation is going to be or what their workshop's going to be, I think, I want to do that, you know? So the way it works is there'll be about 6 to 7 workshops going on at any given time, and you can choose which one you want to go to throughout the day. There's just something for everybody. You kind of have to just pick and choose. You don't have to just stay in one track. So say, for instance, you want to learn about publishing your book, then you're going to go to that one. But you're really interested in seeing this particular poet, you can go to that because there'll be a full day. You have different options. And the schedule will be up on the website probably within the next couple of weeks. So people will be able to see that.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
I wanted just to mention again about the teen program. So the teen program, thanks to the generosity of some of our sponsors, we are bringing that back. And the teens, it's only $75. They have a special session on Friday just for 3 hours, where they'll be mentored by Lori Woodward, who is an author and a screenwriter, and she's a retired school teacher here. And then she's bringing a special guest author illustrator, Stephanie Roth Sisson, to help them through the illustration portion of the program. So they can do that on Friday. And then on Saturday, they actually are invited to come back to enjoy the rest of the conference. And all of that for only $75. And so we are really encouraging that for the teens.
That's a great deal. I wish I was a teenager.
Yeah.
Megan, thank you so much for joining us on Issues and Ideas. I am personally really looking forward to this conference, and I hope that folks in our community are excited to join, and I'm sure that this is going to be a great event.
Thank you.
That was Megan Freeberg, director of the Cuesta College Central Coast Writers Conference. The conference is happening on September 26th and 27th. You can register for the conference and buy tickets at centralcoastwritersconference.com.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.